Welcome to The Marketing Commute, a podcast that explores the roads taken and lessons learned for the best and brightest in marketing today. I'm Mike Boyd, and joining me on the commute this time are Professor Vince Mitchell, Professor of Marketing at the University of Sydney Business School.
Hello.
As well as Carmen Becker, partner at KPMG Australia and leader of their CMO advisory practice.
Hi, Mike.
For the final leg of season one of The Marketing Commute, we are very lucky to be joined in the studio by Ed Smith. Ed's travelled all the way from the UK, where he is the General Manager of Integrated Marketing in the EU for Amazon. We're very excited to chat with Ed later in the show. All right, let's roll.
What's caught my eye this week is Brexit. Well, and the election, it's done now. And one of the things I loved about Boris's campaign was his campaign line. Get Brexit done. It was a make America great again type line, wasn't it?
Look, Boris is very good from his news journalism days. He's very good at playing the media and strap lines. So I just hope he's got a great policy team behind him, because if you think the last 3 years has been full of uncertainty and not knowing what to do, the next 3 years, given the complexity of what you've got to do in order to make this happen, is equally as bad. Yeah, so a majority is going to help with this. But I don't think anybody should be under any illusions. That there are so many minefields yet to go. That it's not exactly a joyful Christmas from this point of view.
Well, there's some people working very hard over in the UK right now getting Brexit done.
There will be. The other thing that caught my eye this week is around this whole idea of these, and Woolies are doing a bit of it here in Australia with the smaller metro stores that they're doing. And I noticed one in Surrey Hills that is completely scan and go. So there's no
Checkout.
Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. It's literally
who shops often, clearly.
Yes, terrible. Yeah. But this whole idea of walk in and scan and go, and I mean, in my suburb, there's actually a big motion at the moment of Woolies are trying to get into the suburb, and they started off saying we want to have this huge one, and council pushed back, and now it's a smaller one, and the council's pushing back a bit. But I must admit, this small one in Surrey Hills with its scan and go, you sort of go, there's the future.
Well, it's quite good actually, because you can imagine that you just download the app and then you walk in, put your goods in the trolley and out you go, and you don't have to wait in the line, you don't have to scan your own stuff, which, oh God, that is not good. And actually, imagine for the store, it's really good. You know, I imagine they have less shrinkage. It's harder to steal. So both ways, I think it's pretty good and good modern phenomena.
The whole idea around data, I mean, all of a sudden the data goes from being on the till or the registry belonging to the supermarket chain, it's data going through my device. What does that do in terms of changing how much information is exchanged?
Yeah, I've got the ethics of this, because it's reliant on your people being completely honest and trustworthy, right? We have some research going on at the moment where there's a system which is an Israeli startup, and you scan it and put it into your trolley. But then as the trolley goes over a weight sensor, it knows the exact weights of everything that you should have scanned. So it knows whether you've underscanned or overscanned. And we're doing some research which looking at the effect that they found is that people who buy more stuff on promotion are more likely to underscan, right?
To cheat the system.
Yes. So the explanation here is that if you underscan something, you have got some kind of fairness relationship. So that the reason that they buy the stuff on promotion is that they think the prices are kind of too high, and they're also kind of underscanning those as well, because they've got some hidden beef, which is coming up. With the people that think I'm paying too much, therefore I'm going to buy stuff on promotion, and I'm going to kind of underscan as well. So I think it's great for convenience. But the checks and balances are a question for me. How you kind of potentially do that?
It's a bit like the honesty box, you know, when you drive through the countryside and there's we've got cherries or honey or whatever for sale, and just put in what you think it deserves. I wonder if they earn more or less than they would if they put a price on it. There must be a theory on that, Vince.
Well, but I think the honesty box, the target is a poor farmer, or it's someone who's you're doing an honest day's work. The problem here we have with big corporations that are making big profits is that they are psychologically very distant from you. So when you're in the supermarket doing your thing, you don't think about the poor checkout person who's being paid by this and may get their wages docked, because not that that would happen, but you don't see it like that. You see it as this big corporation. And that's a very different kind of fairness dynamic, I think.
So our next guest is Ed Smith, who is the general manager of integrated marketing for the EU for e-commerce giant Amazon. Prior to moving overseas, Ed worked in Australia as executive director of sales and marketing at Foxtel. We're very lucky to have him in the studio with us today. Ed, welcome to the Marketing Commute.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
So in most people's career, there's something that kind of kickstarted it, and kickstarting marketing careers is always something unique, and there's always a good story behind that. What was that for you?
So I was an irrigation contractor. I'm a country boy, and I had a lot of clients that were wool growers, and the floor price of wool collapsed due to excessive stockpiling, and my business went broke, and I went up to the snow and became a ski instructor for a year. and that was kind of fun. I remember my dad sitting me down at dinner and saying, if you waste time, time will waste you. Anyway, I then started getting some sponsorship money in for the race department. I worked in school sales, and then they had a really bad ski season and had to cut costs. So suddenly the marketing junior ended up being the marketing director, acting, and one thing led to another, and off went a marketing career.
So wow.
It was a classic case of follow your curiosity if you don't know what your passion is.
Fantastic. Beyond then the ski school, then where does it then start to accelerate in your career?
So I think I had 7 years with the Grollo Group up at Mount Buller, and it was while I was there that I studied my MBA at Monash University. And then once I completed that, a guy called Chris Clark, who had an ad agency, DMBMB Pure Creative, he'd just taken a 50% shareholding in their China operation. And he was having difficulty with that business, finding the right executive to lead it. He wanted someone who he could trust, and I was ready for a bigger challenge. So I literally went from being marketing manager of a ski resort in Victoria to general manager of an ad agency in China. So that was a big leap.
Well, there's nothing wrong with sort of big leaps. And you mentioned before, boy from the bush,
yeah,
is a common theme through marketing. I mean, you mentioned irrigating. How you good on the black pipe cotton irrigation?
No cotton irrigation. I'm very good at the white PVC.
Right.
It was gardens that I was specializing in. But some pretty big gardens.
We've noticed in this first season of the Marketing Commute, kids from the bush become really good marketers. Why do you think that is?
I think marketing is a very diverse career. It requires a mix of practicality, judgment, and I think increasingly data and maths. I don't think that links with being somebody from the country, but I think a bit more practicality, a bit more common sense, having to work on problems where you might not always have the answers to hand might help a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, there's passion for travel. Maybe there's something in
maybe.
That. Yeah. And so what happened after China?
After China, I came back to Australia, and Chris Clark had a tech startup called Virtual Communities. It was right at the peak of the dot-com boom, and he had an incredible vision around digital equality, that there were a lot of working class families that couldn't afford computers. Their parents didn't know how to get their kids online. And so we partnered with industry super funds, church groups, the ACTU, and other unions, and we created this package, $10 a week. Computer finance delivered, installed, connected to the internet, and a whole bunch of social tools. And when I reflect on it, it was actually social media before social media. It was a great idea, just a bit ahead of its time. So my job was to build what we called the enablement business. And from scratch, we set up a business that sold, delivered, installed, financed, and connected to the internet. We did 50,000 packages in our first year, making us the second biggest consumer reseller of PCs in Australia, with from zero in a year. That was when I first got my first grey hair.
Yeah,
I actually remember a consultant from Deloitte. I wanted to pilot it and just have a few orders at the beginning. And Chris is like, no, we've got to go. And I remember saying, we're going to get so many orders. We've not built this thing yet. We've got to test it first. And they're like, oh, what a great problem to have. I didn't push back hard enough. So we took 20,000 orders in 4 weeks. It took us like 6 months to deliver them. It was a real headache.
Wow. Yeah. That's different from what you do now, I guess.
Different and similar.
Delivery in 2 hours.
Yeah.
So after that, when did you get to Foxtel and then to the UK?
After Virtual Communities, I came up to Sydney and took a role with St. George Bank because they were one of our shareholders, mainly because I wanted to have some experience in a big company at some point because I'd worked in smaller businesses. Mm-hmm. That then led to leading News Digital Media and Group Marketing Director at News Corp. And then Richard from Frudenstein, who was my boss at News Corp, he went to be CEO of Foxtel, and I really enjoyed working with him. So I went with him to Foxtel. And then, yeah, on a bit of a whim, Stephen, my husband and I, his dad was moving to the UK and he works with his dad and we're like, yeah, let's go to the UK.
Yeah.
Don't know that I would again move overseas without a job lined up. It was much harder than I realized to reestablish my career from scratch on the other side of the world. I remember having meetings in London and I just was left with this sense that I may as well have been the marketing manager of the Brighton swimming pool complex. I just think it doesn't matter how big or complex Foxtel or News Corp is to us. When you're in Europe, Australia's a little country far away and they can't imagine any business being big or complex there. It was pretty tricky.
Wow. Oh, I remember you did that amazing project though where you went all over the UK and then you got the pulse of the UK. What did you call that? What was it?
So that was my 100 town tour.
Yeah.
I was meeting a headhunter and her partner came in and she picked up my CV and had these schoolmistress sort of glasses on the end of her nose. And she looked at me, screwed up her face and said, oh, it's all a bit Crocodile Dundee, isn't it? Couldn't you do something to dial up your UK experience? And your immediate reaction when you get something like that is, you know, how dare you?
Yeah, I'm like, who do you think you are?
But you know what? I often when I do leadership development stuff, I talk to people about the difference between a victim and a player mindset. And it's very easy to have a victim mindset. But actually, I thought, well, what would a player do? And I thought, well, I've got a year off. Why don't I go and interview a whole bunch of people and I'll come back to London knowing more about the UK consumer than a career marketer who's been in London because they're quite insular.
Yes.
Wow. And then one thing led to another and someone's like, oh, you should blog about it. And I started and my mum read it and said, you need an editor. So I got an editor because I can't spell. Then someone else like, oh, you should film it. So I got a couple of friends who came as a film crew on a few of them and it really snowballed. And then I got a cover story on Marketing Week. I presented at the Festival of Marketing. Mm. And I think, to be honest, probably it even caught Amazon's interest. It's like, that's bias to action and that's really getting to know your customer. And so actually, it turned out to be the making of the beginning of the next chapter of my career in the UK, I think.
So that's a good point to ask you about your career advice, because we often have mentors that give us guidance in which directions. Who were yours and what advice did they give you?
I haven't had that many formal mentors, but I've had some pretty good career friends. So probably the first one was David Malelli, who was executive officer at Grollo Group. He was the one that pulled me aside and said, you really need to finish off your education. So I did my HSC. I did 1 year of science while I had my own business. I failed every one of the four subjects and then bailed out and ran off with my irrigation business and then went and started this ski instructing marketing thing. And he said, look, I can't imagine you with your mobile phone in your company car at 27 going back and doing undergraduate. Why don't you do an MBA? And I said, because an MBA, you need to have a degree. He helped me work with Monash Mount Eliza Business School to get into the MBA based on the career experience I'd had and where I'd got to. And that was a big break for me. And I think being able to do my MBA supported by my employer and finish my professional education while working, that was a real moment. So he was probably the first great career friend.
And what about yourself? Because you're in the position of giving back now some advice. Yeah. So if you were going to advise someone starting out on their journey in marketing, what advice would you give them?
So I do this a lot. I mentor four people each year in the Marketing Academy, a couple more in Amazon each year, and usually one or two randoms that come through my network that I'm happy to do as much as I can. It really depends individually on where each person's at. So, you know, if I was to talk to, I guess, a group of students and give them most broad or general advice for marketing, I think there's two things you need to really set yourself up with. One is a very good understanding of business, how to build a business case and how to understand return on investment for marketing and why would I spend $5 million in advertising or discounts and promotions or product development or just really understanding the basics of a business case. I guess then the other part of that is understanding customer data. So whether that's research and insights or it's behavioral data from the way people interact with your website or your products, marketing increasingly is an analytical skill. And I think a lot of people find their way through advertising or marketing communications. They have a good sense and judgment of what looks good or feels good, but a very strong business grounding will set you up for a good marketing career because ultimately you've got to work with CFOs and CEOs and boards and you got to justify these investments and track them.
And which ones of Amazon's leadership principles have you kind of taken most to, you might advise someone early in their career to kind of take on board seriously?
That's a good question. So if you don't know Amazon's leadership principles, there's 14 of them. They're pretty powerful. Look, your customer obsession, you've got to start there. You know, I think not understanding your customer and what they like and what they don't like and where they are. So start there. Then I think probably as a leader, I think hiring and developing talent is critical. And that served me very well. I'm very careful about how I choose people to bring into the business and how I develop them. Bias to action, I quite like, just getting on with things. I think any big problem, you can really solve that simply by starting. You know, I think so many times I see a project just, it's so hard that you just get stuck, but actually just start, just take the first step, just begin, and then one thing happens after another, and then deliver results. I think, you know, that's really important. You've got to be breaking things down into smaller projects and making progress and delivering results. They're all pretty strong, but they're kind of a few that I feel strongly about.
Being very careful about who you hire is interesting. What do you mean by that? Can you explain that a little bit more, or give us some examples of when you've done that or how?
So the first person who introduced me to that was Gail Kelly.
Oh, yeah.
And she's a great leader. And I remember when I was at St. George Bank, she was adamant that do not satisfy hire. The you may be under enormous pressure working huge hours because you've got a gap in your team and you just want to fill that role. Mm. She goes, but I promise you, if you fill that role with the wrong person, you will create so much pain and difficulty for yourself down the track. Do not satisfy hire, optimize hire. Always get the right person for the right role. It's very much the same at Amazon. We're incredibly careful how we hire. At Amazon, you do two phone screens, and then you'd have what we call a loop, which may be as many as 8 interviews in one day. Mm-hmm. Each person interviews against 2 of the leadership principles. And if you don't have a unanimous panel in the conference at the end of that, then we won't hire that role.
Wow. Everyone, all 8 have to vote yes. Wow.
And they might not all vote yes going into the conference, but then you'll have that discussion. So you may have not heard enough evidence against your leadership principle. And even though someone else was testing against another, they might have heard some evidence and they could give you some data points that might sway you. But I love that. I had that view before I came into Amazon. Their process is more ubiquitous through the whole business than anywhere I've seen before. But this idea of don't satisfy hire, I really believe in.
I'm sure a lot of people have tried or want to try to work at Amazon. So it's really interesting to think about those leadership principles, which are on the website. Yeah. Everyone can see them. So
HR professionals within Amazon are very transparent about that. You'll be interviewed against them. Mm. Think about your career in terms of those leadership principles. So when you want to tell a story about a project you're proud of, think about it in terms of delivering results or biased action or developing leaders, etc.
During your career, you've always had some forks in the road. How are you managing those forks? How did you make those decisions as to which forks to take?
I wasn't born with a passion. I didn't wake up one morning and think, yes, I'm a this or I'm a that. And I think I've always followed my curiosity. So whenever a fork in the road has presented itself, if I am genuinely attracted to that, there's a genuine sense of curiosity or excitement, I've tended to allow myself to be drawn to it. And this is advice I often give to people in their career is don't run towards something because you're running away from something else. Mm. You know, you hate your job, an opportunity comes up. There's an opportunity, I'll jump into that. Always run towards something. I think a burning passion or desire is so much more attractive than a burning platform where you have to get off or get away.
Yes.
So I've just followed my curiosity. Chris's role came up in China. I thought, oh yeah, China, why not? So off I went for a couple of years and, you know, the News Corp thing came up and I thought that was interesting. And it's always just been whatever catches my interest. And I don't know, that makes the days go a bit quicker and you have a bit more fun along the way.
And China was, when was that,
97?
97. So that would have been just a different, mind-blowing. It was that 22 years ago.
It was terrifying. I was young. I wasn't even 30. And I was running a big ad agency with big clients and big problems. And the regulations in China in advertising were still being shaped. Often they were retrospective. Like they'd add a new tax that was retrospective. You'd go to your clients, they say, well, we're not paying that. We've closed our books. And my job was to get that business to break even. So that was challenging.
Wow.
A lot of corruption in those days in media in China, which made it difficult.
Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like working in this sort of customer-obsessed world, and what do you see as some of the trends coming that Australians can be looking for, that you're seeing in Europe around customer, what they're interested in, what they're thinking about?
I'm seeing a few things at the moment. I guess the trend that is probably most strongly emerging in Europe at the moment, particularly in Germany, is sustainability. I think customers are very much more interested now in the environmental performance of businesses that they engage with deeply. So becoming carbon neutral rapidly, having clear policies on sustainability is becoming increasingly important. I also noticed this trend with food in Europe, that being clear about how stuff's sourced, how animals are treated. Is stuff grown organically, or are there a lot of chemicals involved? And that seems to be becoming increasingly important to consumers. And I notice in Britain, as they're looking to do a large trade deal with the US, there's a lot of chatter about US food coming into the UK with different standards than they used to in Europe, where, you know, chicken's grown very quickly and it's bleached so that it can last longer on the shelf and things like that, which you can't do in Europe. So that's probably sustainability, source of food. And then I think thinking about e-commerce, delivery times are getting increasingly shorter. So Kinsey published a report only a few weeks ago. And last season in the US, I think it was 4.6 days was average delivery. And this year it's like 2.6.
Wow.
It's almost halved in 1 year.
Over the whole UK. So
this was
in
the US.
Oh, sorry, in the US.
Yeah, and in Europe, delivery times tend to be a bit shorter anyway because the cities are closer together. But I think increasingly people want stuff same day or next day. So this is difficult if you're trying to improve sustainability performance and reduce delivery times. You know, these things are difficult to manage together.
And bricks and mortar, still a massive part of the marketing mix and benefit for lots of brands.
Yeah.
Where do you see that becoming more of a opportunity across the world as this sort of swing away from, I mean, particularly in Australia at the moment, retail's really doing it tough. It will obviously need to swing back. Europe would have had similar issues, you know, sort of post-GFC and through. Where do we see those changes coming?
Well, I think the key question is to ask with any part of a proposition, why? You know, if you're wanting customers to spend time in a high street retail environment, how are they going to get there? And when they're there, why is that going to be a better experience than grabbing something on your phone at lunchtime, which would have taken you 5 minutes? You can do it, but you've actually got to do it so that it's worth it and that's better. And so I think you'll notice leading retailers, Westfield's a really good example. They have really nice experience. So the experience of going into the retail environment, there's food, there's a really nice collection of shops, they're well sorted. So brands that are likely to appeal to you tend to be grouped together. So you'll find, you know, the more expensive brands are in one area, the cheaper brands are in an area. So people know where to go depending on what their brand preferences are. And that becomes more than in, buy, out. It actually becomes a way to spend an afternoon somewhere to meet friends and experience. Well, that's worth it. But if you're expecting people to just go into the high street and go into a store to pick something up, and you want them to commit 2 hours to that when they could have committed 5 minutes to it and it gets delivered to their door, I just ask why. So you've got to really develop an experience that's over and above selling an item, I think.
And is that example you just used around Westfield, that you said you haven't been back in 3 years, is that something that you've noticed that Westfield's done very well here or replicated from other parts of the world?
No, I think Westfield does it very well here. I think you know, you if you go into any of their centres in Sydney, they're world's best practice, I would have thought. I haven't been into malls in the US or, you know, funnily enough, Westfield in London would probably be the next best thing.
Right.
You know, they're global leaders in experience retail, I think.
Could you tell us a bit about what Christmas is like in the UK from a retailing perspective?
So Christmas as a season in Europe is a bit more like Easter is here, because the month of holidays is in August. So for us, Christmas is the end of the year and the beginning of our big vacation. And so it has it's a much bigger moment in the holiday calendar, whereas, you know, in Europe you take a few days off and then you're back at work. It's kind of a bit like Easter. But it's cold and it's dark and it's a potentially slightly depressing time. So, you know, it's dark when you go to work. It's dark at 4 o'clock. And so Christmas is a lot more about the smell of wintry food and the coloured lights and trying to bring sort of comfort and joy to otherwise what would be quite a miserable part of the year. So in the UK, you know, you have your big Christmas meal and then everyone would watch television together and you're inside and it's cozy.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's a much more inside, cozy kind of experience.
And Brexit, positive, negative for retail?
It's a very complicated issue. I learned a lot about it when I was out and about on my 100-town tour. I think probably the first thing to understand is free movement of people in the EU, particularly in 2007 when the EU expanded into a whole bunch of former Eastern Bloc countries, really changed things. I mean, if you imagine Australia did a free movement deal with Indonesia and Thailand, and Thai truck drivers could come over to Australia and instead of earning $2 an hour, earn $10 an hour in Australia, a whole bunch of them would come out and do that.
Mm.
Well, this is what happened in the UK. You know, a million Poles went to the UK and became painters and truck drivers and things there. And so this huge amount of lower cost labour was a boon for the UK economy, but made it very tough for working class people and tradespeople because there was no scarcity in any of those manual skills. At the same time as that huge population growth, the government's got their austerity strategy, and so they're not investing in new hospitals, new schools. The NHS, their Medicare is very precious to people. So as an average worker, your wages are being depressed. You are having trouble getting your kids into a local school. You can't get your kids in to see a doctor quickly. It's very easy to blame that on the European project. Layer on top of that, a whole bunch of Syrians coming in after the war to Germany, paranoia about Islam extremism. That's enough to create a big body of concern about globalization and a backlash against it. So everyone's got their own reasons, but that were really kind of the driving forces. So then we've had a lot of uncertainty. And regardless of what your politics are, I think most people now in the UK, as witnessed by the election, just want to progress.
Mm.
There was a referendum. It was Brexit, whether you want to stay or not. Now let's do it. And I think that's why Boris got such a big majority. And I think that big majority now and a good mandate will get Brexit done. They can move on to their trade agreements with the EU and the US and others. And you know, there's a lot of work to be done, but I think now we have a lot more certainty, so it'll be less harmful.
So positive times ahead for that part of the
less
world.
Less negative.
Less negative, yeah. There we are.
I don't know how positive. I mean, Germany, if it's not in recession, is almost in recession.
Mm.
And so I think we've had 10 such big growth years. It's now going to be interesting what the next 10 years look like and how much growth there will or won't be. The UK has an advantage. It's got its own currency. And so when there's uncertainty, the currency becomes weaker, which makes them more export competitive. But they don't want to lose access to the European market. That's key to negotiate now.
So close, and it's right there on their doorstep. It's be mad to turn your back on that.
One of the things a lot of marketers here think about is the impact of GDPR on European businesses because the laws in Australia are reflective of GDPR and said to change again. So have you got any learnings you could share from your knowledge about data and data privacy and customers?
GDPR, I actually think for customers is a good thing.
Mm.
And so if it's a good thing for customers, then I think it's a good thing for business. And I think it's important for marketers when they design their policies and they design the way they manage and handle data, they don't just do it within the law. They do it with a sense of good spirit towards their customers. So if you're retaining and using data and it's not to benefit the customer, it's to benefit your business, that should be a red light. Mm. If you're using and retaining data in a legal way to enhance the experience or product on behalf of your customer, then that probably should feel okay. So I think you can really use your intuition and your sense of what's right and what's wrong just by thinking, is what we're doing here in the interest of the customer? And the GDPR stuff usually helps you with that.
So data is certainly one thing the future is going to be predicated on. Yeah, where in other areas do you think marketing's heading? And is it heading in the right direction?
It would depend on the business and the sector, but I think accountability has been a theme now that's been growing. You know, I think CEOs and boards look at marketing investments as pretty large investments, and I think marketers having woolly things like old brand love and You know, that's why we invest in one, you know, grow preference or whatever. I think you need to be one or two steps further ahead than that and be able to demonstrate to the business what 1 point change in a perception or 1 point change in brand love is going to equal commercially. So I think marketing has got to increase its path to accountability, measurability, and also keep the art. It's got to be beautiful. It's got to entertain customers.
On that, the art of entertainment, the art of insight, yeah, because marketing is becoming more measurable, yeah, right, and often there's criticism that if you can't measure it, you can't manage it, and therefore we're only going to manage things we can measure, yeah, but there are those parts of marketing which are very hard, yeah, to kind of capture, and yet we all see the genius, yeah, when it's displayed to us. So in your experience, have you... Yet you're seeing any yet great examples of how that insight can come about, or where those future insights may come from? If it isn't from your data, it's still from an art form.
Look, I think it's always possible to measure. And, you know, obviously if you're a small business in one country or one city, it might be more difficult. But the advantage of many of the big brands today is they're global or they're multi-territorial. And you can then look at the difference in brand attributes by area, and you can make an investment in one area, change attributes, and see what that yields economically. So you should always be designing your marketing programs in ways that allow there to be observations of differences, and therefore by proxy measurement. That always should, the bar should always be high on that, I think. And then, you know, when it comes down to making beautiful creative, it always starts with a good brief. And you can, again, test before the campaign goes live and you have a lot of measurement. Is the message that we want to deliver through this campaign actually being delivered? It's pretty easy to be methodical on that stuff, I think.
And so what does the road ahead look like for you?
That's a really good question, and I've been thinking about that a bit. I think I was 50 this year. I'm interested in what I'm capable of. I had 2 years in Luxembourg in this role leading marketing in Europe for Amazon. I wanted to relocate to London so I didn't have to commute every week. Amazon's accommodated that, and I still find this role fascinating, and it's got a broad scope, and so a couple more years in that role would be fine. But I think my next gig would be a big chief operating officer or a CEO role. So I'm beginning to build my network with fund managers and businesses that invest in other businesses that would require talent like that. I did the Marketing Academy Fellowship this year, which is delivered by McKinsey. Amazon's a very big company. They might have the scope to expand my role within a couple of years to meet that aspiration, to test myself out. But otherwise, I think after a couple of years, I'd be looking for a CEO role.
Well, Ed, thank you very much for spending some time with us this afternoon. It's been a really, really great chat and learning about sort of your perspective from Europe and how you sort of see the world, and certainly some of your principles around your team and developing people and so forth has been fantastic. So we really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So for the Marketing Minute, yeah, this week, I've chosen something from Harvard Business Review, yeah, which looks at how to design product pages that increase online sales. So the variables they looked at, yeah, which had a 10% increase on purchase intentions, were trustworthiness of your brand and whether your product is easily evaluated or not. So they have two ways of deciding whether it's easy to evaluate. The first, yeah, is by search. So search products are things that you can evaluate, yeah, through the information you get prior, yeah, to actually purchasing them. So you don't have to touch or feel them. And what they found is that factual information can increase sales. That's not potentially, yeah, very interesting. But what they also found, which is more surprising, is, yeah, that if you emphasize on the same web page things like warmth, sociability, human touch, that actually can potentially suppress sales. So you don't want that for search goods. In contrast, experience goods, which are the touch and feel things, yeah, like buying fruit and vegetables or things like that. For experience goods, yeah, what you do need is you need to describe these goods in a very personable manner. So using a conversational, yeah, kind of style. Yeah. So you'd use adjectives like, would you like a faster internet? Yeah, so you put in pronouns like you or your, as well as adding video displays to products, shows that they're represented in an appealing, engaging kind of way. So the takeaways on trust are that if your brand is trusted, you should strengthen the information aspect of your product page. But if your brand isn't trusted, then you should strengthen the entertainment aspect of your product page. So, interesting findings with a 10% potential increase in sales. Any thoughts?
As you were talking about the experience side of thing, I was wondering if you were going to mention video, because you see that now becoming so much more part of basically e-commerce, whether it be reviews or whether it be here's how you use it, you know, and experiential type things. It makes a big difference in the way if you're looking at a new camera or a new phone or whatever it is, looking at ways of this is how you get the most from that particular product because this is how to get the most from that experience. Video is obviously a massive part of that now and is only going to get larger.
Made me feel a bit sad about the if you're not trusted, be entertaining, because that seems to be an extreme reaction to perhaps a brand that has a passive score where people aren't quite sure yet whether they're jumping into trust or not. And I guess what it's saying is you need to be more entertaining the less you're trusted. Is that right? Is that what that is saying? Have I interpreted that correctly?
Well, it's about what's the thing that's going to get you most sales. If you're not trusted, yeah, and you can't just on a web page just invent trust, right? What's your best strategy? Yeah, is to entertain people, to get them over their trust issues, yeah, in some which way, yeah, and divert them away from the fact that they don't trust you, I think is the conclusion.
Mm. I mean, if your brand's not trusted, is that not sort of day one of brand
it's a
building?
Big marketing problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a big sort of thing.
So if you're day one or year one of your launch of your company or your product, it's not easy to say, oh, well, you should be more trusted, right?
Yeah.
So this is a potential strategy, to get people over that potential issue.
Interesting.
Well, that's it for this season of The Marketing Commute. Thanks very much to today's guest, Ed Smith from Amazon, to Professor Vince Mitchell from the University of Sydney Business School, Harman Becker from KPMG, to our producers Boyd Britton and Madison Lunds, the studios here at the University of Sydney Business School, and to KPMG's customer brand and marketing advisory team. You can find The Marketing Commute in all good podcast networks, and you can read more detailed show notes and find out more information about our guests and presenters at our website, themarketingcommute.com. We'll be taking a short break, but stay tuned for season two. We'll be talking to even more fantastic Aussie marketing talent. I'm Mike Boyd. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on The Marketing Commute.
You have reached your destination.